The Bob Murphy Show, episode 312.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome back to The Bob Murphy Show. Today I'm going to be speaking with J.P. Cortez, who is the executive director of the Sound Money Defense League, which is a nationally renowned policy group known for its fervent commitment to advocating for a stable and constitutional monetary system. Just reading a little bit here from JP's official bio. He's a graduate of Auburn University. Cortez's strategic acumen shines through his initiatives to champion the role of stable monies in an era of increasingly volatile currencies. With legislative victories in more than a dozen states since 2018, his work encompasses grassroots advocacy, educational campaigns, and collaborative endeavors with like-minded organizations, all aimed at fostering a broader understanding of the vital link between sound money and individual liberty. His articles and analysis have appeared in Reuters, Business Insider, Huffington Post, Newsweek, Washington Examiner, and more. He's also the lead author of the Sound Money Index, an annual report that ranks all 50 states to determine which states offer the most pro-sound money environment in the country. And as a side note, I've known JP for a while. As it said there, he was in Auburn. And so whenever I would go down there, either for the entire summer during one stretch of my life or just for Mises U later on, JP and I would always be sure to hit the karaoke bar. So fond memories there. Without further ado, here is my discussion with JP Cortez. JP, welcome to the Bob Murphy Show.
Bob, it's good to be here with you. Thank you for having me on.
Sure thing. Yeah, glad to do it. So I have mentioned already in the pre-recorded intro that you're the executive director of the Sound Money Defense League. But tell the folks, where did the league come from and how'd you get to be the executive director and kind of what's your background in terms of getting into all of this good stuff?
Yeah, sure. So my background, I was getting an undergraduate degree at Auburn University down in Auburn, Alabama, when I learned that right across the street from the business building that I'd been spending a bunch of time in sat the Mises Institute. So I found myself skipping class, you know, skipping the classes that I was paying to attend to go run off and sit at the Institute and read in the library and ask people questions. And I, you know, studied Austrian economics, and specifically, I grew passionate about sound money and the importance of sound money, the harms of inflation, and the effects that a money has on a civilization. So I came out of college, came to Charlotte, North Carolina.
Can I stop you, JP, for a second?
Yeah.
Was the, because as people know, I've been down in Auburn a bunch, and I was at the karaoke bar when, no, actually, I wasn't the karaoke bar. I mean, I was at the karaoke bar more than once, but the anecdote I have in mind, I was checking into the Auburn Hotel in the, what do you call him, a bellboy? Do we still use that phrase? The kid.
The
helping
attendant?
Me, yeah. Yeah, taking my luggage up. We were making chit-chat, and he asked me where, and I said, yeah, we're at the Mises Institute, and I said, it looks like the X-Men mansion, and he went, oh, that place, okay.
So that's a dead giveaway. Yeah, that's how you know you're in the right place.
Okay, so yeah, that's what I was going to say, like before – like as you were just a student there, like how did it get on your radar? Did someone mention like, yeah, you know that building in that spot? Like, in
yeah, there's actually right next to the Mises Institute is a Auburn staple watering hole and sandwich shop. So I spent a lot of time there, you know, after class and such. And I saw the building there, obviously. And you know, I'd heard from someone else. I'd been given a little pamphlet about, I don't remember, why study Austrian economics or something like that. And I, at this point, in a moment of serendipity, I, in high school, senior year, was assigned a project. You were told to pick a politician to study and give a report on in our government class. I was agnostic and told the teacher that I didn't really care. And she assigned me one. I just told her to pick one for me. She chose Ron Paul.
Really?
Yeah, just totally by chance. And that's sort of how I discovered some of this libertarian stuff, and then getting to Auburn. As I continued to study and learn about this stuff, the Mises Institute obviously came up on my radar. That's how I found.
I was waiting for you to say like Grover Cleveland or something, or Calvin Coolidge, and no, it's Ron Paul.
No, okay. Yeah. It was Ron Paul. That doesn't feel that uncommon. There are many of us that there are dozens of us that came in through Ron Paul.
It doesn't surprise me that Ron Paul was your gateway drug. What surprised me was when you were saying the anecdote about your teacher just giving you a political figure. And that's what set you on the path to, you know, the small government or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, had she given me Calvin Coolidge, I would have ended up in the exact same place.
Right.
Studying at Mises, and when I came out, I, you know, again, felt passionate about sound money. And I met up with an entrepreneur here in Charlotte who had a background in public policy, working at National Right to Work. In DC for many years. Stephen Gleason is his name. He's owner and president now of Money Metals Exchange, a bullion deposit or a bullion dealer. And he wanted to fund or start a public policy project. And I was young and out of college and feeling very passionate about these things. And so we teamed up. We noticed, you know, that the reality is, you know, the US dollar might be the best money that exists today. By my count, it isn't. But I mean, it might be, but we don't really know, because the reason we're all using the dollar is honestly because we're trapped. All the other alternatives have been shackled with taxes and disincentives and a bunch of other reasons why they're unworkable as money. So we recognize that this is a problem that can be fixed with good legislation. And so we decided to start this project going state to state nationwide, remonetizing gold and silver as constitutional money.
Okay, this is fascinating. So maybe just if we can dwell on the theoretical point for a moment before we get into the details of the specific projects you guys are working on, or bills you're pushing, or whatever however you want to describe it. Yeah, you're right. There is a school of thought that says the U.S. dollar right now is clearly the money of the United States. You know, you gold bugs can whine about maybe it's unfair, maybe it's because they cheated back in 1933 or, you know, 71, whatever date you want to look at. And maybe in an alternate universe where coercion hadn't been applied in the past, Americans would still be using gold as money. And so some people would say silver, whatever. But that's not the universe. But as of right now, the argument goes, it's not coercion propping the dollar up, but just, if you want to call it, network effects. The reason you accept dollars is because you think everyone else is going to accept dollars tomorrow. And, you know, your landlord wants you to pay him in dollars. The grocery store is accepting dollars. You got to pay taxes and da da da. And that's why it is what it is. And this is true, JP. I'm not just saying this like as a hypothetical. One time somebody asked me, hey, when you guys, you know, go and give talks to the Mises, do they pay you guys in gold? And I said, no, they pay us in dollars. And why? Because, you know, for all the reasons I just said, that if we had to go back home, you know, the grocery store takes dollars, don't take gold. Mm-hmm. If I wanted to buy gold, I could take the money they give me in dollars and go buy gold if I want to. But by them giving it to us in gold, they're kind of forcing that. And then we just have to undo that transaction to, you know, to make it more liquid. So there's that school of thought, but it sounds like you're saying, no, there actually is constant coercion that's helping to prop up the system and maintain the dollar in its current role.
Yeah, that's definitely the argument that I'm making, that the government has imposed, both state government and the federal government, and regulatory agencies of the federal government, the IRS, in many cases acting unilaterally to classify gold and silver as collectibles, for example, is one example of a decision that was made not by elected officials, but unilaterally by a regulatory agency that has massive ripple effects on its taxation. And that has massive ripple effects on its use as money. So like I was saying, the idea right now is that gold and silver are not able to be used as money. It's unworkable because of the friction that exists on either side of the transaction. So in 7 states here in the United States, when you buy gold and silver, you're going to get hit with a sales tax. In the majority of states, when you sell gold and silver, you're going to get hit with a capital gains tax. And then on the federal level, you're going to get taxed on capital gains again. So there's too much friction involved in these transactions to be able to make it workable as money, right? You don't want to track your cost basis every time you buy a gold coin. And then when you spend it at the grocery store, you hope that the coins you use, you bought at the same time. So the cost basis can be tracked easily. And then you have to pay, you know, any taxes on any gains. And it's just unfeasible. It can't be done. There's too much friction. There's too much, it's just not able to be done easily. And so again, maybe people wouldn't use gold and silver as money. Maybe people for whatever reason would choose the liquidity and the mass acceptance of the US dollar over reasons like constant debasement or funding atrocities around the world. Maybe some people would still prefer how acceptable nationwide and globally the US dollar is. But the reality is that we don't know. We don't know because the alternatives, there is certainly not a free market for money. The alternatives are being taxed. The government and the powers that be want you using the dollar. And so, again, on the state level and the federal level, they've imposed all of these disincentives. And so we're going state to state, removing all of these thorns and these briars so that not only so that people can use gold and silver if they want to, can adopt their own gold standard, but so that there can be innovation in money. We're seeing in a creative, innovative, entrepreneurial way, innovations in money that we've never really seen before between Bitcoin and even some things in the crypto space and things like fractional gold. We have now actual bills with gold inlaying in them. The technology now exists for things like that. And so allowing innovation within this space, I think it speaks to the importance of sound money. It speaks to why the US dollar is a bad monetary instrument and why, on top of it being a bad monetary instrument, America's stewards of this bad instrument have been acting badly with this monetary power. So they've shown that they can't be trusted with it. And for that reason and others, right? Sound money is important.
Yeah. I was listening to everything you're saying, but also part of my mind was going off on a tangent, just trying to process what you were saying there, because that it's what I was trying to come up with was to say, is it really true that there's a double standard that, you know, one merchant who uses the dollar, you know, we're obviously, folks, for this discussion, we're talking about people in the United States, just to keep it simple. So some merchant that's using dollars versus one that's trying to use gold coins as how they do their bookkeeping and whatever. And you're right, JP, because I was thinking, well, what would it mean like if you were using dollars, but then there was a capital gain on that? Like, would that be, so, you know, suppose you get some revenue from your customers and you got hundreds and tens and twenties sitting in all the tills of your register. And then what if there's massive price deflation for whatever mm-hmm. reason and prices come down? I was thinking, would you get hit with a capital gains or some, an income tax or some kind of tax? Then when you go to spend the money, because you're, you know, now like trading it away or you're, mm-hmm. you're selling. And no, you wouldn't, because everything's all priced in dollars. They would say, no, You know, that $10 bill, you got it at $10 and it's still $10. So there's no capital gain. What are you talking mm-hmm. about? It's a 0%, like by definition. So it's almost right. Like our tax code is predicated on the dollar being the money, the unit of account, mm-hmm. as well as the medium of exchange. And so, okay, so that's interesting. So I guess, you know, how would you get I'll stop there. So I'm partly walking through this too, mm-hmm. JP, for the folks mm-hmm. at home, just so they can kind of wrap their head around it.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, could somebody say, like, I don't know, if a French bakery wanted to open up and say, no, we're just going to use euros in the U.S. Like, if you're not sure, I don't know either, like how the taxation works on that.
I'm not sure how the taxation would work on that. Because my understanding is you don't pay capital gains on currency, right? Or no, because you can invest in currencies. People are buying dinars, and I don't know how much of it's being reported, but any sort of gain on currency, there is a taxable, that is a taxable event, right?
I don't know. Yeah, it's funny. Like, I know what you're talking about, like, because there's things with, if it's a currency, then that's a different kind of thing, mm-hmm. and it's not an, and that's, you know, partly with, you know, Bitcoin and how they were going to regulate that originally. And like, is it a commodity? Is it a currency? What the heck mm-hmm. is it? And I know that was part of the issue because it wasn't clear, even if you did report it and everything, like, how are we going to tax
right.
it? You know,
right.
what are we going to consider it to be? So, okay, well, let's, since it basically the answer is you and I don't know, let's leave that aside. Let's talk about things that
yeah,
we do know.
Yeah, back to what we do know.
That at least one, how about, yeah, from this point forward, at least one of us should know what's going on in the conversation.
So all right,
go ahead. But at least now people, I think, do have the idea. Also, let me just mention too, I don't know if this is on your, maybe JP, this is like the story you guys tell when you're, you know, passing marshmallows around the campfire, and this is a, but I don't remember the details. Maybe you can fill it in if you remember this, if you understand the story I'm talking about, where some employer was trying to pay his employees with it was U.S. currency, but it was like coins from before 1960. And so they had silver content. And so I'm making these numbers up, but it was like he would pay them what looked like $5 face value, but it was really $100, mm-hmm. like in terms of market value. Mm-hmm. So like if somebody who, you know, really he owed $100 to, but he would give him $5. And then that's how they reported it on the books, saying to the IRS, no, I just gave him $5. Like it's legal. You know, you guys said mm-hmm. it's legal tender. That's what this is. I'm not saying it's $5. You guys are saying it's $5. And the IRS was like, give me a break. We all know.
yeah. We know
silver,
what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, silver's worth more than, you know, what we say it is. So, and he got hit with that. Is that mm-hmm. is that case on your radar? You know what I'm talking
I've
about?
I've heard the case, but it's not something I know a ton about.
Oh, okay. So anyway, but this is for folks at home, like another example of the kind of thing we mean where it's, you know, people who could try to get around the system. And again, the backdrop to this, JP, is I've had people over the years say that yes, there was a period where it was illegal. You couldn't even hold gold and you couldn't even have contracts with what were called gold clauses. Mm-hmm. So it's not merely that FDR said, turn in your gold. He said, you're not even allowed to use like the world price of gold as a benchmark in your contracts to say, yeah, I'm going to do this task for you. I'm going to sell you this bushel of wheat or whatever. And then you're going to do this for me next year. But when you pay me back, let's consult the world price of gold and you pay me in dollars, the equivalent at that time of 3 ounces. You weren't even allowed to do that. That was unenforceable right. in the courts.
Right.
Whereas now you can do that if you want technically. And so the question is just, okay, well, you Austrian libertarian types, if gold is so great and now people could contractually get back into it, how come they're not? So go ahead.
Yeah, and so not only theoretically can you do that, I'm actually mm-hmm. happy to say that we actively write and pass legislation that includes this provision, this idea that specific performance should be guaranteed in contracts denominated with gold. So if you and I have an agreement to be paid in gold, the U.S. dollar is not a substitute for being paid in gold. So we've written legislation like this. We've worked to pass legislation like this to enshrine it in a state's code that specific performance on gold and silver clause contracts be guaranteed.
Okay, great. So what is it that you guys do? Is it mostly like model legislation and then you go around trying to find willing sponsors? Is that the model?
Well, yeah. So I think we sort of do everything. It is admittedly a skeleton crew. I'm the executive director, and I have some administrative help, but it's mostly primarily just me. So when we started in 2016, when I came in, you know, Sound Money wasn't exactly dinner table conversation. So I was writing model bills and I was actively reaching out to legislators, begging them, hey, please introduce this bill, consider carrying this bill. Mm-hmm. And that was in 2016. And I think 2017, we passed our first bill in Wyoming. And then the year after that, there were a couple of states that started reaching out to me and to different groups asking, hey, this Sound Money thing that happened in Wyoming, how can we be a part of that? And from there, it's snowballed. Honestly, this year, currently, by my count, we've got 63 bills, 63 pieces of legislation introduced across 24 different states to remove disincentives to end taxes on gold and silver, be it sales or income or commercial activity or personal property taxes, bills to empower a state treasurer to invest state funds in physical gold and silver if they want to, bills establishing in-state depositories, and bills allowing states to hold their reserves, their pension funds in physical gold and silver. In one case we're working on, there's a Kansas bill right now that I was in Kansas testifying at earlier this week to develop a transactional currency and a depository for the state. So are as far as the Sound Money Defense League, it's a pretty robust group of issues that of policy points that we've been covering, and it's just been tremendous growth. We've seen that just last year, six states passed legislation, sound money legislation, and in many cases, we're seeing that a state will pass sound money legislation, and then not long after, I'll get an email saying, "What's next? What's the next step? What else can we do?" And that's been really heartening to see. You know, there are about 9,000 elected state legislators in the United States. The vast majority of them have never heard the term sound money. They've never thought about money or where it derives its value, where it comes from, or why we use it. So on top of being able to pass legislation, it also serves as a platform to educate the people that are making decisions that ostensibly affect all of our lives.
Okay, well, great. So maybe we can unpack some of that. Is it worth, is it illustrative if we like go to that very first one, the Wyoming original one, and you explain like what was in it and lessons learned, that kind of thing?
That was great, actually. I was, I think I was probably 24 years old, traveled out to Wyoming where we wrote the bill, traveled out to Wyoming, found someone to sponsor it.
Well can I stop? But just like how did you, why did you pick Wyoming first? Like that was your guys' call, or like you existed and then someone from Wyoming put out feelers, or how did
that
happen?
Yeah. So I guess when I first came in, my first order of duty was to go through every single state's code, find out what laws are currently on the books so that we can find out what laws need to be passed. Mm-hmm. And so naturally target states or states ripe for this kind of legislation emerged. And Wyoming was one of those. So, you know, among those first batch that I drafted and reached out to legislators, Wyoming, the heart of Wyoming, and was the first to be keen on doing something like this. And now we see, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, we see that Wyoming is a sound money haven, right? You have Caitlin, oh my gosh, what's her last name?
Long.
Thank you. Caitlin Long, writing and passing legislation, working in Wyoming, working within the state capitol and working by herself with the Bitcoin Bank custodia that she's working out there. So Wyoming itself has become a haven for sound money. So that was in the hearts of the legislators there at the time. I went out there. I remember in a suit that didn't even really fit me, in my, you know, nerdiest, trying to be overly smart. I remember giving testimony on the Cantillon effect and why it's so important that, you know, people understand that central banks or monetary systems like the one we live in today benefit the people closest to the money first. And by the time that money trickles down to you and me, prices have adjusted. And now we're getting more expensive money. And I gave this very long, what I thought was a heartened, impassioned speech. And ultimately, it passed. It was voted out of committee. But I very quickly learned that there are audiences within legislators, and some legislators don't necessarily care about the Austrian economics behind what we're doing, or mm-hmm. the constitutionality even about what we're doing. And I guess that speaks to the importance of having a well-rounded message, right? Some legislators do, in some cases, care about Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution, and, you know, adhering and showing fidelity to our founding document. And some legislators don't. Some legislators care more about business development and hearing about how in-state dealers are losing business to out-of-state dealers because the states remaining with sales tax are completely surrounded by states that have ended the tax. So it's a variety of arguments that we have in our tool belt on a number of different issues. And so we're just, you know, playing to the audience when I'm speaking to the Democratic caucus of X state. You know, my arguments might be shaped a little differently than when I'm speaking to the Republican caucus or a Liberty caucus in any given state.
Okay, great. So what specifically was that first Wyoming bill? Do you remember?
Yeah, that was House Bill 103. So that was it defined specie legal tender. So it defined gold, silver, coins, bars, and rounds. It reaffirmed them as a legal tender in the state of Wyoming. And it gave constitutional protection, specific performance on contracts. And it precluded gold and silver from any tax liability at all. So any future taxes that may arise, gold and silver are precluded from the tax being levied upon the metals. So that was that first bill that we passed. And that was sort of the snowball that began other states wanting to do more and more of this.
Okay, great. Yeah, and I'm like, as far as having gold and or silver like as a hedge, like you're saying, with it, if there's taxes on it, in a scenario where it does exactly what you wanted. Oh, wow, prices went through the roof, and so my gold and silver shot up. So now I'm, you know, at least I'm somewhat compensated, right? Well, no, not if the government comes along and hits you with a big tax on the so-called gain.
Yeah, that's the thing there. It's the so-called gain, right? It's a phantom gain because, you know, the value of gold hasn't changed. It's a change in nominal prices. That's a quantification of the U.S. dollar losing value. So this gain, quote unquote, that you're being taxed on is a phantom gain. And, you know, similarly, there are on the sales tax side, right? If you were to walk into a gas station and exchange $1 for four quarters, and the gas station attendant charged you a 7% tax, you would say that's crazy. This is asinine. I'm just exchanging one form of money for another. And that's exactly what you're doing when you're exchanging U.S. Federal Reserve notes, because they're not U.S. dollars, the strict definition of the dollar as the founders understood it. The U.S. Federal Reserve note for constitutional money. It's a money exchange. So for that reason and others, it shouldn't be taxed either.
Can you expand a little bit, JP, on that? Like, I'm sure plenty of my listeners have heard people use phrases like that, but strictly speaking, like, I can imagine a lot of them are a little bit squeamish if you put a spotlight on them and said, hey, what's the difference between, you know, a Federal Reserve note and a dollar as specified in the Constitution? Like, what do you mean constitutional money? What does that mean?
So article, the gold and silver are the only form of money mentioned in the U.S. Constitution. And the founders knew the dangers of fiat money. You know, Madison, Jefferson, they wrote that paper money is a disease, that it makes a lottery out of all private property. So they understood the risks and the damages of fiat currency. And so for that reason, they enshrined it in the Constitution that Article 1, Section 10, saying no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt. The Article 1, Section 8, which regulates Congress, gave them the power to regulate coin and took coin money. And so you mentioned earlier that in 1933 and 1971, and then even before that, through the legal tender case, the legal tender cases that went through the Supreme Court and the Civil War before then, while America's money was founded in gold and silver, pretty quickly thereafter, the soundness of the money began chipping away. It started with Abraham Lincoln needing to fund the Civil War, passing the Legal Tender Acts, and then you know the story, obviously, of the greenbacks and the hyperinflation that took place here in the United States. And then after that, the imposition of the income tax, the establishment of the Federal Reserve, and the closing of the gold window ultimately in 1971. So while we started in gold and silver and in sound money as the founders thought, what we have now is closer to an IOU. It's paper money, not backed with anything. It's a debt liability. It doesn't extinguish any debt in any real way. So all of this debt is simply floating around. And the goal then is to remonetize gold and silver, what we know to be a hedge against inflation for thousands of years, and allowing people to, again, if they choose. A big part of this legislation is that you can't compel anyone to accept gold and silver if they don't want to do this. So this isn't this doesn't mandate anyone to do anything like that, but it simply gives people the option because, you know, historically, throughout history, when people wanted to save money, they simply held the money because the money itself throughout history often was gold or some sort of standard. That is not the case today, right? If you hold money today, you're subject to the inflation tax. So you're paying a penalty for holding cash. Your other options are to invest it. You can try your hand at the risky stock market casino. Try your best at understanding ETFs and stocks and bonds and mutual funds. So you're throwing your money into that roulette. Or you can spend it immediately to try to get the most out of your purchasing power. Then that obviously incentivizes or makes consumerism and it draws people towards that. So in any case, with an inflationary money like this, you have no good options. And it will continue to be debased and people's savings will continue to be zapped away. And the founders knew that. And that's why they wrote it into the Constitution. And what we have today is so far away from that. It's an instrument of theft and deceit. It is not an honest weight or measure.
Yeah, so I'm glad you emphasized that, JP. So just to elaborate on that for the folks at home to make sure they're getting the critical point there, that right now you can imagine somebody, you know, they could have a well-balanced portfolio. They can have some stocks, they can bond, they got real estate, they got this, they got that, maybe have some Bitcoin, but also you have gold. You know, whether you physically have coins or bars, you know, sitting in a security safety deposit box in a bank or, you know, with some holder or whatever, or an ETF form, like you say, you could have that. And that's just, you could say, oh, it's just sitting there, but, you know, oh, it can go up over time and it's a good hedge in case things go sideways in terms of the dollar's purchasing power. But what you wouldn't do is just take lots of hundreds of dollar bills and put them in a piggy bank in your bedroom, right? And just let it sit there for years at a time, you know, absent, you know, like a bug out bag or something. Okay. Mm-hmm. You want to have some cash, but you get the point. I'm sure folks that nowadays that would be, or at least it'd be very costly. You'd have a high opportunity cost of just sitting on actual currency in any significant amount. But historically, when the dollar was tied to gold and or silver, then even if you just kept actual, you know, dollars in your bedroom or something, or under the bed, or, you know, hidden somewhere under the oak tree, that would be equivalent to as if you had the actual gold and silver coins there, because, you know, for that regime, when that was in effect, you could exchange, you know, your U.S. currency for the, you know, the appropriate amount of gold or silver. Mm-hmm. And so just like it wouldn't be crazy for you to have back in the barn some gold coins hidden somewhere just in case, or that's just a good thing to have there, then you wouldn't worry about it losing its value over time because, hey, it's gold coins. You know, like in the Goonies, when they find all that, you know, the pirate's treasure, no one's like, oh, geez, you know, these gold coins have been sitting around for a long time. They're not worth anything now. That's not how you think when you see a pile of treasure like that. So likewise, to have a bunch of $10 bills or whatever, that's not a bad thing if it's under a regime where that actually, you know, can get exchanged for
something, right?
Yeah.
And okay, then, and you speak, you know, the likelihood that is the case, right? If you and I were to both die today, and in my pocket you stuff a 1 ounce gold coin, and in your pocket we'll put $100 bill, 100 years from now, if they were to dig us up, I'm very confident that the gold coin in my pocket will have retained its value. I'm also pretty confident that the $100 Federal Reserve note in your pocket will have diminished in value. And I think, you know, I think people are looking for assets. They're looking for places to save their money. I had a piece on Free the People earlier this week where I wrote that, and this is a point I make when I'm testifying before committees in states, that at a time when people are actively seeking places to put their money at a time of high inflation, against a backdrop of bank failures. People are starting to question their money, and they're looking for places to put their money. And for so many years, for decades in America, the instrument that people have used to save or grow their money has largely been home ownership. But the reality is that that door has closed for so many people here in the United States, and they have limited and more limited options to being able to store their money in a place that will preserve or even grow in wealth. And gold and silver for thousands of years have been one of those places. So that's something I like to present when I'm speaking to legislators, that, you know, if this is something that people can reliably put their money, this is a place where people can reliably put their money. The U.S. dollar is losing value. It's a sinking ship. And on this Titanic, we have shackled the lifeboats with disincentives and with taxes, and we have to unshackle them to unlock their power as an inflation hedge, as a store of value. So that's one of the points that we make when we're going around talking about these issues.
Okay, so if we could just go through, you know, some of the main elements of what you were talking about, the different types of proposals. So one of them you said was getting rid of like sales taxes and capital gains. So for those types, it's very narrowly targeted, right? Like, so it's a state where there is a sales tax and you just convince them in some cases exempt gold and silver from that.
Right.
Out of curiosity, maybe this is too much in the weeds, is it like there is a sales tax on the numismatic value, but like not in terms of the raw, or is it, you get what I'm asking?
Yeah. No, most of the legislation that we write, the bullion is defined, as we define it, as items that are valued primarily by their weight and their purity. So for example, a 1,000-year-old super rare coin, copper penny that'll sell for $10,000, that would still be taxed. That's not a bullion right. item. That's a numismatic item. So in many cases, what we're talking about here are IRA-approved items. This, even by government standards or by the standards that govern retirement accounts, gold and silver are an approved asset in that way.
Okay, great. How does that work? Okay, so I guess that's partly where I was coming, because I could imagine some of the other, you know, merchants getting upset mm-hmm. and saying, hey, that's not fair. But if you right. are, you know, someone limiting it to just like the pure bullion aspect of it, then that's
yeah. Okay. And we're explicit about exempt or not including, for example, jewelry and things that don't meet certain purity per specifications and stuff like that too. So to be sure, while I believe nothing should be taxed, the way right. we're writing this tax policy is narrowly to ensure that we're talking about constitutional sound money here. That's the point.
Right. And obviously, and that's why I'm tracking with you. And again, for the folks at home. So it's because I can imagine if it's a state with a sales tax, like they get a lot of revenue from that. So your strategy when you're talking to them, you could say, look, it's a very narrow exemption we're talking about here. So it's not like you're going to lose all of this revenue.
Right.
It's just opening up the corridor for people who want to use this as a, you know, a lifeboat can go ahead and do that.
Right. And I think we argue as well that not only will the state not lose a lot of revenue, it's likely or possible that they would increase in revenue. You know, coin shows, coin conventions are very large businesses, and they have a rule to avoid states that charge sales tax on precious metals. So if you're looking at a fiscal analysis and you're wanting to do static analysis, sure, you can say that the state will lose $1 million in revenue year over year. But if you wanted to do more dynamic analysis, you could say, okay, yeah, maybe the static number is this, but we're also bringing in conventions that will go to various cities across our state various times a year, where you have tourism dollars, hotel dollars, restaurant dollars, all of those things. The second order effects will more than make up for the tax revenue lost in direct taxation of these items. And on top of the revenue, obviously, the politicians care about the revenue side, and I get why they care about that side. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about taxing money. It's an inappropriate tax because you shouldn't be taxing constitutional money. It's an inappropriate tax because it treats gold and silver as a consumable good, which is obviously not the case. It's held for resale. And that's actually kind of one of the issues with states that charge sales tax and capital gains tax on gold and silver. They're double dipping, right? They're saying gold and silver are a consumable good, taxed the way you would tax a pair of shoes or a hamburger. And then on the other side, they're taxing that when you sell as well. So they're taxing any gain, saying that they want to treat it like a capital asset. So they're talking out of both sides of their mouth by doing that.
Right, right. Yeah, it's not like when you invest into a mutual fund, there's a sales tax
exactly.
on
exactly. There is okay. no – states don't charge the purchase of stocks, bonds, mutual funds. That's because they have the tax on the back end. Mm-hmm. So to treat gold and silver like both of these items and tax on both sides is inappropriate as well, outside of moral standings on why sound money should
right.
not have obstacles to getting into. Mm-hmm. I think you were asking about different types of legislation. So yeah. there's the sales tax stuff, which we've got active legislation right now on sales tax and capital gains tax in Alabama and Georgia, Hawaii, Iowa, Wisconsin, Vermont, just to name a few. There are also states that are doing some different policy projects that they're carrying as well after they've laid some of the groundwork with the taxes. There are states, for example, I was in Nebraska just a few days ago testifying in favor of a bill that it's a capital gains tax exemption, but it also has anti-CBDC language. You may have seen or heard some of these bills that are being passed around the country declaring that CBDCs cannot be foisted upon the citizens of any given state, or that the state cannot define CBDC as money and force people to pay taxes in it, things like that. Mm-hmm. So that is one of the tenets of this Nebraska bill that we're working on. Another cool little policy project in North Carolina, we've got a bill that calls for a study to establish a depository here in North Carolina, which is where I'm based, in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's a depository to store the state's gold and silver holdings, but also their Bitcoin holdings. So we're partnering with the Blockchain Association here we put some language together, and we got this bill out of the House. So now it's on to the Senate. So yeah, we're working alongside other sound money advocates like Bitcoiners, Blockchain Association folks, people like in Campaign for Liberty, for example, who still has a big voice across the country on liberty policy matters. The 10th Amendment Center, another great group on these issues. Mm-hmm. So we're working with all them to leverage grassroots to encourage people to be an active participant in their legislature. I think if you don't get listener, if you don't get anything else out of this conversation, I think I would encourage you, or I would hope that one thing would be to realize that you do have a voice in your state capital. That isn't necessarily the case in DC. You can call your representative, and an intern might pick up the phone. They might take your message. The congressman might get it. They might not. In Nashville and in Madison, Wisconsin, and in Frankfort, Kentucky, and in Jackson, Mississippi, in those places, to call a Capitol switchboard with 20 phone calls or 20 emails on one single issue raises all sorts of red flags, and people are paying attention. It doesn't take much on the state level to make a difference on this state legislature stuff. So I think something I like to even... as an anarchist, as someone who doesn't believe in the political process as a means to bringing about the liberty and freedom that we all really, really want and care for, I have seen the power of just a handful of people making phone calls on single issues that can take 5-10 minutes of your time, but have a massive impact on a bill's ability to be heard and voted on favorably.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm glad you said that. I was going to actually... ask you that it seems like you're saying there it is certainly worth your time doing this, and that to get people motivated at the state level, at least, it's not just a hopeless cause.
No, I don't think so at all. But now that we've talked about how the federal level is a hopeless cause, let me tell you about the federal pieces of legislation we've been working on.
Go ahead. Yeah.
So Representative Alex Mooney out of West Virginia has taken the sound money torch. And over the last couple of years, he has carried a couple of sound money bills that we've worked with his office to help with some of the language that we're pretty excited about. There's a bill to it's a gold standard restoration bill. This bill would peg the price, the dollar, to a fixed weight of gold. And it would also call for an accounting, a deep accounting of any gold or any transactions regarding America's gold holdings, which hasn't really been done in quite some time.
Can I ask, is it, is it like, did it, how did it pick the price, or is that not determined yet?
It doesn't pick the price. It, it lets the market fluctuate. And then after, how long was it? Oh, 30 months. After 30 months, it will set at whatever it has fluctuated and naturally gravitated to.
Oh, okay. So that's actually, it's similar to, Mises' proposal of how does a country go back on gold. He didn't pick 30 months, but similar to what you're saying. It's not that you just pick some number.
Right.
And then hoping it's like, no, you let the market and then you just lock it in. And then his deal was going forward, then any new money that's issued, they have to get that amount of gold and, you know, put it in the vault somewhere to back up the. So it's not that all the outstanding dollars instantly become backed by gold, but going forward, the new ones are fully backed. And so over time, a larger proportion of the existing dollars is backed.
Yeah, that's how that would work. And I think, you know, something I think is cool because it's something I spent a lot of time thinking about and learning about. These approaches that we take are rooted in the Austrian tradition, are rooted in the works of Mises. The, you know, that what we're doing here, the denationalization of currency and currency competition is Hayekian through and through. So it's an application. I'm very fortunate to have spent a lot of time studying this stuff and learning from you and so many others at the Mises Institute to be able to then practically apply it to my life and to my job, be able to live out some of those principles. That's been great. So back to federal federal legislation. The second bill that he's introduced is this capital gains bill. Like I mentioned, there is the sales tax by the state, the capital gains tax by the state, and then again, the feds will tax you on any capital gain. This bill that Mooney has introduced would back out any capital gains or losses from your federal tax, your AGI, your adjusted gross income. So that in one fell swoop, because many states use the federal AGI as a starting point for their state's AGI, to remove it on the federal level would be to do it, broadly across the board. That would be a huge win to making gold and silver usable as money again. And then that last bill is the Gold Reserve Transparency Act. This is a bill that calls a full audit of America's gold holdings. You know, decades ago, there was a made for TV, made for Hollywood sort of quick camera view of some gold bars in a dark room and then panning away very quickly. And there hasn't really been a full audit and assay of America's gold holdings in a very long time. So this bill, one, would call for this audit and assay. It would confirm that the gold and silver is still there. It is where it says it is in New York banks or Fort Knox or wherever. But importantly, it would also call for a report of any encumbrances that might have been placed on this gold. So the gold might be in Fort Knox, but who owns it? Does China own it? Does Russia own it? Are there any encumbrances, loans, leases, any sort of financial encumbrances placed on this gold? So this would call for that sort of reporting that the GAO auditors would put out if this bill were to pass. So, you know, it's not... In general, I do sort of think the federal level is not necessarily the avenue to go down if you're wanting to pass policy. It's very slow moving, and you're trudging through the mud. But we have here a champion of sound money who's carrying these bills, and it bolsters the arguments for us in the state that the feds are looking at this too. We're grateful to have them. We're grateful for the people that are carrying these bills. Ultimately, you know, we couldn't do it without them.
Well, also, too, on some of that, like I could see auditing the federal government's gold holdings. I don't know the particular, but it wouldn't shock me if you could get a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren or AOC on board with that in terms of just like yeah, let's see what these jokers have been doing. You know what I mean? Like, it's more of accountability as opposed to an ideological thing about hard money or something.
Right. You know what I mean? But Senator Warren has been too busy introducing legislation written by big banks, so I don't think she'll have time anymore.
Oh, so many hours in the day. But like I said, I was throwing their name. I wasn't saying in particular. Sure, wouldn't shock. But you get my point that
absolutely.
As opposed to someone saying, let's get rid of the federal minimum wage because read this pamphlet from Tom DiLorenzo. Right. AOC is not going to be on board with that.
Sure.
Whereas, yeah, this one, even though, you know, we're supporting it because of, look at how much the government has debased the currency and the, you know, inflation's the most monstrous thing. Even someone who doesn't care about that, but still, like, yeah, if the government has been short selling the gold market and lying about what the reserves are, like, the people need to know that.
Yeah, I mean, you would think they'd care. You would hope they care. I don't know. I think a lot of politicians don't see gold as money. They don't see gold as an asset. If you told any given amount of them that central banks are actively buying gold at neck-break pace, I think some of them would be surprised to even hear that central banks are still doing that. So yeah, I'm not necessarily bullish on really politicians left side or right side of the aisle be jumping up in arms to sign on as a co-sponsor to this bill. But you know, my fingers are crossed. Stranger things have happened.
Yeah. Can you, in the time we have remaining, focus a little bit on the, you said the depository element. So how does that, am I right in saying some states now they have it where people can come and hold gold, you know, at the state level? And then is it something like that, like that's going to be more of a bulwark against like federal, because you can hold gold all kinds of places right now. So I've heard people say, what's the point of having your state codify that? But is it partly because that's like more secure from federal overreach?
That is exactly one of the reasons that we make for why a state might consider establishing its own depository, right? Like, as I believe you mentioned it earlier, 1933, the Executive Order 6102, FDR confiscated America's gold holdings and made it illegal to own gold. And so as a protection against this federal overreach, the state might have a stronger constitutional argument for saying no to the feds if something like this were to happen. Whether or not that will happen, that is hard to say. I will say the reason FDR did that in 33 was because gold was the backing of America's money at the time. So in order to print more, you had to have more gold. Today, that is not necessarily the case. It is definitely not the case. So I'm not sure why they would do that, maybe just to be mean to gold bugs that have been poking fun at them for many years. But yeah, that's one of the arguments why a state might want to do that. In Texas, famously, Texas has a bullion depository that they established, I believe, in 2018. That is sort of regulated by the government, the state government, but it's run by a private company. The reason they did that was because Texas already owned $1 billion worth of physical gold in their teacher pension fund. They have since divested from that investment. So now the depository just sits in the state. I don't want to call that a boondoggle, but it's looking like it might be with enough time. The Ohio is a state that also holds gold.
Sorry, can you, I'm not, that wasn't on my radar. What, I don't understand what you're saying. Can you just walk through that a little bit more?
The state
of Texas, who did they sell it to? The pension fund.
The gold?
Yeah. You're saying they
sold it on the, yeah, they sold it on the market. They no longer own gold on that balance sheet.
Okay, but you're saying it's still sitting in the bullion depository.
And no, likely not. The bullion depository is there and private citizens can open and transact accounts in there. But the $1 billion that was there, I don't even think it ever got moved in there. And that's kind of maybe boondoggle was too strong a word, but the idea was Texas saying, no, we want our gold that's currently being held in New York vaults, bring it to Texas. We're about to get a little into the weeds, I'm sorry, but there are COMEX regulations that say that COMEX-approved gold has to stay within 150-mile radius of New York vaults. The reason for that was from some historic rule that said that horses can only run 150 miles given the weight at a certain time or in a certain amount of time. So COMEX regulations govern or say that. Completely serious. That's why the COMEX market operates out of New York and Delaware, because you can't find it. There is no other approved depository that's not within the proximity to each other. So Texas built the depository with intentions to take back their gold. COMEX said, if you do that, you're breaking the chain of custody of the gold. Your gold is no longer as liquid. You would have to get it assayed. It would break the chain of integrity. And so Texas ultimately said, no, we're not even going to do that. So they no longer own any gold. Ohio does. They own about $1 billion, several hundred million dollars in their police and fire pension funds. And now there are several other states that are considering this same thing, establishing a depository, whether they pay for it, the issue with having the state pay for it themselves is that in many cases, the states don't even own a single ounce of gold. Asking them to take on a multi-million dollar project to build a bullion depository is a hard sell. So there are states considering that still. There are states going the investment route first, maybe held at a depository at a contiguous state or something like that before maybe eventually establishing their own. So there are a lot of different avenues to go down, and that's sort of the beauty, or at least the idea of the state experiment, right? All of these are little individual sandboxes, and we get to figure out which public policy will emerge the best based on all these experiments.
Okay, well, great. So big picture as we wrap up here, what do you foresee as, like, is there going to be a point, it's some, you know, the next 5 years where there are a group of Americans that you could plausibly say for them, gold is once again the money they're using? Or is that not really what we're shooting for?
I think it's a small group, but that I could say that now. I think that there are places in Utah and Wyoming, some of those corners that have vendors and have merchants that accept either digital currencies backed by gold or some of these new technologies that I was mentioning where it's literal gold foil and it looks like a bill, it's shaped like a bill. And that sort of works into the psyche, I think, of like, whoa, gold is money, because that's how Americans tangibly think of, and that's how they know money. It's in this square little rectangular form. Right. And so to do that, yeah, I think on top of the legislation, on top of all of policy wins, I think that there are already places where people have denominated their lives in gold. I will say there's something to be said about Grisham's Law, right? If I don't necessarily know that people want to spend their gold, even if they could. But in general, having a state develop the infrastructure, which is what some states are doing in some cases, having a state develop the infrastructure to be able to accept taxes or remit payments in gold and silver, being able to value it and store it and assay it, and having that infrastructure built now before a state truly needs it, is prudent, if nothing else. And we're encouraging states to do that, and states are taking it upon themselves to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm all for certainly everybody getting the infrastructure ready. And like you say, or not like you said, but part of elaborating on what you just said there, that, yeah, I think as more and more people have gold in their portfolio, and especially if it's very easily tradable, you know, whether you're using like Tether gold or, you know, these things that that it's, you know, a digital version of what's ultimately backed by physical gold. So it's really easy to transact in, and then people get more and more comfortable with that. And then if the dollar were to crash for whatever reason, I mean, they're running it so responsibly, why would it? But suppose it did, then they're not starting from scratch. Like, they have that system they could quickly ramp up. It's sort of like having a, you know, militia in place, and then, oh, we're about to get invaded, and it's easier to ramp that up if you've got, you know, some already the infrastructure up and running.
Yeah, we're not building from barren land here.
Yep. Okay, well, if people want to learn more about what you guys are up to, where can they go?
Check us out, soundmoneydefense.org. Actually, if you go to that page, you'll see a a short little sign-up form that asks for your email address and your zip code. I encourage everyone to submit that information if you're interested in getting involved in these state laws. The reason we ask for the zip code is because we segment our email lists. That way, if you live in Wisconsin and there's a hearing in Wisconsin tomorrow, I will write up an email and I will send the contact information of the legislators that are the key legislators on the committee, and I will send that to all of our email addresses that are labeled in Wisconsin.
Well, could you give us more than a 24-hour notice?
Yeah, unfortunately, many states, the state legislative schedule many times is planned very promptly. You'll know as soon as I know, I promise. Okay. but I encourage everyone, if you're wanting to get involved, I strongly encourage everyone to do that because you do have a voice. You can also find me on Twitter. My at is JPCortez27 or X, excuse me. I'm regularly posting legislative updates and such on there as well.
Okay, well, thanks. So, folks, my guest has been JP Cortez, the executive director of the Sound Money Defense League. JP, thanks so much for what you've been doing. And I'd like to say, hopefully, we won't ever need it, but you get what I'm saying. So,
really great talking to you, Bob.
Thanks for coming on. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. We'll catch you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.